This is Fresh Air. Being alone can offer a much-needed time for reflection, or it can be hell. It can be something you desire, or something you're forced to endure. My guest, Sue Halpern, has written a new collection of essays called Migrations to Solitude. She writes about solitude in its many forms, from hermits who've chosen to live deep in the woods, to monks who've taken vows of silence, and prisoners serving time in solitary confinement. And she writes about why she and her husband moved from New York City to a small town in New York's Adirondack Mountains. One essay is about a solo camping trip she took in the woods near a lake. It didn't turn out like she planned. She picked a spot where she'd hoped to be alone, but a surprising number of other people had picked nearby spots. And once she was there, she wasn't always sure how to spend her time. Here's a short reading.
If the forest were a room with a door, I'd probably be inside, reading. But the open wood demands something else. A hike up the ridge, an hour with the chickadees, something like that. Solitude would appear to be defined by place as well as dependent upon it. What passes for being alone at home, say, wouldn't pass here. You don't pitch a tent to curl up with a novel.
Why not?
Well, I guess because my sense is that when you go outside, you should be experiencing the outdoors. And when you are reading a novel in particular, you're relying a lot on your interior life and you're living in your interior life. But on the other hand, I mean, that's my sense of what at least is expected. My instinct is always to get the novel out and start reading.
I think there's anything wrong with that.
No, maybe not, but I sort of, there's this great tradition of, you know, going off into the woods and, you know, doing something. And I was trying to figure out, like, what is it I'm supposed to do here? Because, in fact, I really wanted to just, you know, crack the book and start reading. But then I thought, well, I could just be at home. I could be doing this at home. I should, you know, should the place I'm at, I should, you know, get something out of more than perhaps just the fact that I'm now separated from, you know, the place where I live.
One of your essays in your new book is about a couple who lived together as hermits for about 40 years. Did you relate to that when you met them? How did you find them?
I was at a meeting, a public meeting about land use in the Adirondacks, which is a big issue. And there was a man who got up to speak who looked unlike any other person in the room. Part of it was that his clothes seemed to have made in sort of circa 1930. And he just cut a very striking figure. And so when the meeting was over, I wanted to find out who he was. And I asked around and I was told he was a hermit, which seemed a little contradictory because we were at a public meeting. But I was told that he was a hermit who felt so strongly about this issue of development in a wilderness area that he decided to come out of the woods. So I went back to him and I explained that I was working on this book and I thought that he might have something to tell not only me but other people about the kind of life he lived. And he and his wife agreed to let me come and spend some time with them. So I did, and they live in this really gorgeous spot on about 150 acres. And they were smart enough to build their house very, very far into the woods. And they cut a trail in, but it's very difficult to find unless you know what you're looking for. It has some markers. And I found their lives interesting and remarkable. And yet I understood pretty soon after I spent some time with them that it wasn't the life I would choose. But I thought they were admirable for doing it, although I think they wouldn't think of themselves as being admirable. They would think that they had no choice because they couldn't live in the material world that most of us find very, very congenial and comfortable.
I think there's two kind of standard ways of viewing hermits like that who've made the conscious decision to live alone in the woods. One is to take a kind of romantic view that it's you know, the life of solitude, a life of reflection. The other is to kind of place it square in the center of the crackpot tradition of American eccentricity.
Yeah.
In which did you find this fitting in? Some of both?
Both. They were very, very nice to me, and yet because they didn't really have a lot to do with most people, their socialization and their sort of social skills were probably putting them closer into the more eccentric camp. But they had managed to construct a life that objectively is just so elegant that it's very hard not to romanticize it. And what I mean by that is that they had figured out, and without training, how to build a house, and not just how to build a shack, but how to build a beautiful house, and how to get hot water without having a hot water heater, and how to have tomatoes, really good, juicy red tomatoes in the middle of winter, and how not to go to the store. They had figured all these things out, and they did it in a very quiet way. They didn't do it, you know, by sort of reading a book, and they didn't do it by having to go to graduate school. They just figured out, they thought, you know, life is a process, and we're going to figure out our lives as a process, and they have.
In writing about solitude, one of the things you wanted to write about was solitary confinement. So you actually wrote to Robert Stark, who has been or was in solitary confinement at the Louisiana State Pen, and he had been on death row, but his sentence was changed to life. He was 34 years old. How did you come up with the idea of writing to him?
I wanted to write about solitary confinement in part because it's back to this idea of romanticism. It seemed to me that in talking about solitude, that I couldn't avoid looking at situations where it was not a romantic ideal, where solitude, in fact, was something fairly horrific. And I wanted to find someone that had spent a lot of time in solitary confinement, and I have a friend who's a nun who works with death row inmates in Louisiana, and I talked to her and asked her who I should be talking to, and she suggested this man, Stark, and so we started to correspond, and that correspondence lasted quite a while and was a fairly chastening experience for me because even though I had had this idea of a sort of a lack of romantic ideal about prison, I still started asking him questions that he found to be so naive and so stupid, and he pointed that out to me pretty early on.
What kinds of questions?
Well, I think that the key question was, I said, so what's the best thing about solitary confinement? Thinking, you know, maybe he would have some insight about it that, you know, I'm not sure what I was thinking he would say. And he said, you know, there isn't anything good about it, you know. And I realized that it was sort of my own fantasy or my own projection that, you know, one was going to be able to find some goodness in this hell. And, you know, he pointed out very, very clearly that that wasn't true, and that if you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail and most of the rest of your life in solitary confinement, there is nothing good about it.
Stark, in one of his letters, in answer to your question, what's it like to be in isolation, wrote, it's like having hell all to yourself.
Yeah, it was that moment when I read that, and I thought, you know, that is as pure a description as I've ever read. Then it went on. I mean, I asked him to describe very succinctly the physical characteristics of the room that he was in, and he did that. And again, I mean, it was just, you know, reading language like his, which is very spare, is just can set chill, you know, send chills up your spine, you know, because it's not, you know, he was not a novelist. He's not writing, you know, hey, you know, my cell looks like this, it's like this, it's like this. He's saying, this is how I live my life. I live my life in a room that is essentially the size of a bed. I wear leg irons. I'm not allowed to wear underwear. I'm not allowed to read books. I cannot have a pen. I'm not allowed to talk to people. There's a light on 24 hours a day. That's not fiction. That's real. And when you're sitting in your house in the middle of the woods reading this, looking out the window at your beautiful mountain, and you read, you know, it's just horrifying.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sue Halpern. She's written a new collection of essays called Migrations to Solitude. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sue Halpern, author of the new book, Migrations to Solitude. Another place that you went to get a sense of what solitude is like was an abbey, a monastery in Kentucky, and this was the same monastery that Thomas Merton had been in. Why did you go there?
I wanted to go to a monastery for a couple reasons. One was I was really intrigued, and I thought I probably would never put myself in the position of being in a monastery and even going to a monastery as a visitor, as a tourist. But now I had the opportunity to go as a journalist and as a writer. That was part of it. I also wanted to go someplace where people lived in silence. I was really intrigued by this idea of silence and what it leads to. And I knew that by going to Gethsemane, which has a rule of silence, that I too would be bound by that rule for as long as I was there. I wanted to be able to feel that myself and to look at that and to observe it and then to relate it.
What conclusions did you reach?
When you live in silence, you tend to use language very sparingly when you use it at all. And as a consequence, language takes on a whole new meaning and it has a kind of added value. When you use language the way we do, which is as a form of, you know, daily communication, its currency is kind of inflated. I mean, people just talk. Words are cheap. And in a monastery, you use very few words. And so you choose your words pretty carefully when you do speak. And so to that end, for me, I came to really appreciate the value of language. And I think as a writer, that's also a wonderful thing to remember. So there was that. There was also this idea that here was a community of men that lived fairly close together, and yet they were able to live in that way, in a very harmonious way, in part because they were not speaking all the time. They were not speaking hardly at all. And it was a kind of social lubricant to be silent. And I noticed this with the people I was with on retreat. They were all strangers to me. I knew nothing about them. I wanted to know nothing about them. And yet I had very warm feelings towards them, I think in part because I wasn't distinguishing between one or the other. By being silent, I didn't know their views, say, on abortion. I didn't know their views on, you know, whether President Bush was a good president or not. I couldn't listen to their accents and get a sense of who they were from that. And as a consequence, I didn't make distinctions or judgments about them. I just thought, here are a bunch of people on retreat who are looking for something, whether it's for God or for some inner peace or whatever it is they're looking for. And that was my basis for knowing them. And it was a kind of equalizing basis because I didn't have any, sense of them outside of that quest.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you started wondering if there wasn't perhaps something misanthropic about this sort of retreat, because it's easier to think kindly of strangers if you don't need to talk to them or if you don't need to listen to them.
I think, you know, and always with solitude, I think there is an edge to it, and it might be this misanthropic edge. For me, in that setting and in almost any other setting, the reason why that's useful is because it's temporary. I don't think that I could go on relating to people solely on the basis of, you know, of not knowing them. Because there is a sense, I suppose, in which, you know, ultimately you're not making any connections. I think what's so useful about solitude is that it allows us to hear ourselves think. It allows us to come up with an idea of who we are. It allows us to ask questions to ourselves about who we are, and then it gives us the space to answer them without other people coming along and saying, well, no, you can't be that way, or no, you can't do that. And it gives us a certain amount of freedom. And we take that with us when we go back to being with each other. And I think, in the end, what it is that solitude lets us live with each other. It lets us live in communities or in families. And I think it becomes misanthropic if it's simply an end in itself.
Well, Sue Halpern, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, so much.
Sue Halpern's new book, Migrations to Solitude, is published by Pantheon.